8:49 p.m. Tuesday, October 5th, 2021.
Welcome to Oh Yeah Dude.
My name is Jonathan Lariquette, and this is Seth. Hello, Seth.
Hi, this is actually Jack and Lisa. We're just big Oh Yeah Dude fans.
Which I haven't listened to in a really long time.
Let's get off the Oh Yeah Dude train.
No. I love Oh Yeah Dude. Shout out to the oldest and best podcast ever.
For real. It was the first podcast. Did you guys know this?
It's in the Bible.
I don't know if I can hear myself. Can you turn up my monitor?
Which one's the monitor? Up top or down below?
Down below.
You're up. Keep talking?
Yeah.
That's good, man. We'll see what happens. We'll just see what happens.
No, this is for me to be able to hear myself.
Well, great. Now you can hear yourself even better.
We're doing great. So I'm Jack. That's Lisa. This is episode 37.
Six.
What did I say?
I just looked this up. This is episode 36. We're off to a great start. This week we are covering the Beastie Boys. Paul's Boutique,
1989. I feel like this was a reach, getting you to reach this far back.
It was.
Like, it was. No, I hate you too.
Here's the thing. I can reach around the 80s. Wow. I'm big on the reach around past the 80s, past the late 70s, early 70s, late 60s. That's my sweet spot. 80s I have trouble with.
Yeah.
We will start there. 80s I have trouble with.
I'm glad we've spent so much time here in the 80s, but there's so much good music done in the 80s. Don't make a little smirky smirkster face.
I was four years old when this came out, just freshly turned four.
And you were negative 9,000 when Yes and all the other great stuff happened in the 70s. So don't act like
it has
this.
Nothing to do with. I'm just. No, I know this has nothing to do with that. I'm just saying I was four, so I didn't actually get to experience this album. I don't know when. I think my first memories of Beastie Boys were Sabotage.
Probably, yeah.
Which would have been several years later.
You were an MTV kid. Mm-hmm. You would have seen a lot of Beastie Boys.
Oh, they did
the
90s. Not stop playing that video forever.
Spike Jonze. That's Spike Jonze video.
Of course it was.
Yep.
There it is. Spike Jonze comes full circle.
Many, many connections. Well, here's your connections. If you remember the Chemical Brothers,
mm-hmm.
couldn't get called the Dust Brothers because the Dust Brothers, who produced this album.
Yes,
so
I was reading
nice
up on that.
Another little through line.
Mm-hmm. I was like, hold on, it's...
Hold up, am I learning about the musics?
I didn't ask for this. You did ask for this. You started a whole podcast about it, you moron. Released July 25th, 1989, was their second studio album behind License to Ill. Beastie Boys is from New York City, in case you didn't know that. And it's made up of, it's pretty clear.
There's one thing they wanted you to know.
It's pretty clear.
From New York.
They are made up of Mike D. Diamond, Adam MCA Yock? How would you say it?
Yock. Yeah.
And then Adam Adrock Horowitz. Is that, can I see? Horowitz here, sorry. Yeah, RIP MCA.
2012.
Is that when we lost him?
Yeah, he's gone longer than I remembered, which is tough.
That one was a weird one to have lost. I remember when that happened to be like, what the hell? Why?
Well, the guys are like in their mid-50s, so yeah,
was it cancer?
Yeah. Cancer's a beast. I don't remember. It was not a good, not that there's any good kind of cancers except for the one you get away from, but.
Right.
Woo! Anyway.
Yeah. You are low tonight, actually. I'm going to turn your mic up a little bit. So, yes, this their debut album, License to Ill, came out and rocked the world. Paul's Boutique was slower to catch an audience.
Less rock the world. Yeah. But that to me is why it's interesting. I don't feel like you need to sit up and defend License to Ill, although it has its own controversy because of this, as it got labeled, you know, frat hip hop, which I think is accurate in many ways because that was my experience of it in high school, a very nerdy high school. People loved singing songs from License to Ill because it exactly had that sort of snotty, like, yeah, well, dad, are you going to make me? That's kind of that whole perfect encapsulation of that mood. And yet they would spend pretty much the rest of their career distancing themselves from that.
Was that the one that had You Gotta Fight?
Yeah, Fight For Your Right.
Okay.
Fight For
Your
Right.
I mean, that was an
Girls
undeniable.
It is very jockey. It is very fratty. It is very sort of prankish. But I don't think it was maybe fully received, certainly later, as social mores change, but even at the time, some people were like, some of their friends were like, nah, not cool, dude. So
right,
even though it was a very successful album, it was the first rap album to chart at number one on Billboard top charts. First rap album.
Beastie Boys?
License to Ill? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
How frustrating must that be, though?
It is. It is. It is frustrating for, yeah, for a black art form. Yeah, I'm sure it is. But, you know, you get your feet in the door. There's no one questioning the ascendancy of rap now in popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, no, I'm sure it was probably a little tough at the time, to put it mildly. But that's what's interesting to me. So you don't need anyone to defend or talk about, in my mind, License Ill. It's there. It's a complete document. You can listen to it. It is a party. It's a great time. As were some of their later stuff where they started to get back into play, because they're all very accomplished musicians in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
They would play their own. They played a lot of their own stuff on the first album. They played a lot of the stuff on the 90s output. And they would go further afield and play quite freely with lots of different, you know, inflections, jazz, hip hop, whatever, live instrumentation, sample driven stuff, records and classic turntablism, everything under the sun they were interested in. In fact, I love there's an instrumental album that they have. And actually, I'm a big fan. I really like that album.
Oh, I bet that would be amazing. Which one is that?
I
didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's an instrumental album. I was a big fan of it in college, but cannot remember at the time. Anyway, it's a great time. They're
I bet I would
a
like
very
that
varied.
More.
Yeah, it's
yeah,
it's a very varied record discography, but. My interest lands on Paul's Boutique because it's that tricky second album.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here I feel like you get the modern Beastie Boys basically immediately. Like in their reactionary kind of like, okay, hold on a second, everybody. We had a good time, didn't we? Yes, we did.
We did.
But we're smart. We're smarter than this album seems to paint us as, and certainly our reputation seems to paint us as, and we're going to do a little course correction here. And then they went, basically, and that's crazy to me, to go from, you know, they formed in the late 70s as a punk band, as a mm-hmm. sort of a hardcore, you know, punk band. And so that's how they, you know, they knew how to play, and they played a lot of their stuff on Licensed Ill. But then come 1989 in Paul's Boutique, it's almost entirely samples.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a big change, especially in 89. That's a big
exactly.
change.
Exactly. Yeah. It would not be crazy later on. Now, I mean, that's part of what I love about coming to a Kanye record is not that it's all sample based, but seeing where what he mines, what he puts it, what he recontextualizes, he raises it to that level of art.
Mm-hmm.
And to think back and see, well, no wonder no one's ready for that in 1989. It's like, what is? I mean, even listening to it now, it's a dense record.
It's very dense. Yeah, this was a lot. This was a lot to take in. But also in the same way, it was not a lot to take in.
Mm-hmm.
So for me now switching the track a little bit to Lisa's dilemma. I've always had trouble with the Beastie Boys. Not that I don't appreciate their music, but after a song or two, I find them hard to tolerate.
Right.
And so there's only so much like menacing white boy rap I can subject myself to before I'm like, okay. Because is it Mike D, the one that's kind of got the more like slightly more shrill rap voice?
Yeah, I think you're probably thinking of Mike D.
Yeah, it just his. He to me is like the Puff Daddy of the group. No offense, and that he's just always like circling around. I'm so
you
wrong.
Might be thinking King and Rock. Anyway, you can tell MCA because he's the little raspier.
Right. Voice. No, and I like he is a breath of fresh air. I know his voice. Whomever the more shrill one is the one I'm like, yeah, I need you to go get us some pizza. Go to the one. In the other side of town, upper east side, please.
Right,
and come back.
We're gonna put down some tracks in the meantime.
Right. But that being said, a lot of credit goes out to them for this one because of how much sampling there was in this. Yeah. Because once I sat with that, because again, as you know, you saw me, I listened to it in the background once or twice. Then I start getting a little more serious and then I do my research and let everything fall into place and realizing how much sample work there was. And this is like, okay, this is impressive. And then I understood why you chose this as opposed to Licensed Ill.
Right.
Even though I think a lot of people feel like this was their big one, it was just in the shadow of Licensed Ill.
Right.
So I read that they got 95% of their samples cleared to the tune of $250,000.
Yeah, which is absurd. It's approaches to clearing samples and what it would cost would skyrocket, especially after the Bismarck case. So that's part of what it makes this such an interesting time capsule. Not only was that the practice of sampling, it was so ahead of the time, but samples that you cannot get cleared anymore,
right?
I.e. a ton of Beatles samples, mm-hmm. is not something you get to pull anymore. That the next time that would happen in hip hop, in my mind, would be, of course, the Gray album, which is Danger Mouse's famous remixing of Jay-Z's The Black Album with samples pulled from the Beatles' White Album.
Whoa. Oh, cool.
Did you never hear
no,
this one?
No.
Oh, my gosh. When
Danger Mouse, you said?
Yeah. Danger Mouse. That's how he made his name. It's an incredible. And, of course, it's all flagrantly illegal, so he didn't charge for it. He just put it out there, just like how a lot of that's where mixtapes, you know, exist in hip hop, is that you don't have to clear your stuff if you don't charge for it. Really, they don't tend to go after you for doing that. So people will try and make a name for themselves with some really ballsy plays, but it's not a commercial thing because they can't clear those samples. So to take the bones of the White Album and say, no, we're gonna take these songs and we're going to turn them into backing tracks for this album, because I don't know how he got his hands on the acapella tracks for Jay-Z's The Black Album, but like it's great. It's a lot of fun. Not all the tracks hit, but the ones that do are inspired enough that it's like, oh my gosh, this is a total recontextualization. It's so much fun. It's fun for Beatles fans. It's fun for Jay-Z fans. Right. It was just a lot of fun. But that's literally the only other time that I think you'll hear Beatles and hip hop and a Beatles sample getting just thrashed around, and people are like, whoa. Like, I mean, Girl Talk might get away with some of it too, but that's been years too. So anyway, it's just interesting. Like it's crazy because you're not going to hear Beatles. You're not going to hear a lot of big acts. I mean, there's a Led Zeppelin, there's Pink Floyd. There's a ton of samples. We're not going to sit around and talk about particular samples because we're going to be here all day.
Correct. Yeah, per song.
It's incredible. It's very, very, very dense.
Pink Floyd's Time on here, but I couldn't quite catch the sample in the track it was in.
Oh, yeah.
But whatever the case was. Wasn't Danger Mouse the one that was playing in Hutto nearby that one night that we could hear? Was that, or was that Dead Mouse?
It was Dead Mouse.
It was fucking
another
loud.
Mouse-related.
Do they both wear the same mask?
Yeah, it's weird. They have to. It's a timeshare kind of arrangement.
It's like a custody battle.
Who give me the mouse mask? I need to perform tonight.
Give me the mouse mask and free my soul. I want to rock everyone in Hutto and make them mad.
They were mad. They were mad about the Dead Mouse.
Okay, so this album, going track by track, I don't think is terribly useful, but I'm happy to do so if you'd like, because there's some interesting stuff happening here. And I really didn't think that there would be much to the lyrics, and there were ish. But for me, BC Boys is all just like, make a fun beat, make a fun rhyme, make it snappy. Like, it'll play.
Yeah. Well, and like you say, I hear that. I hear that when you have three guys going basically concurrently for every song, with very few exceptions, it does kind of have the same kind of effect, especially because they do the same sort of overlapping.
Yes. Yes.
Like finishing each other's sentences. You imagine.
Correct.
All three of them. I know this wasn't the case, but you imagine all three of them wearing one very long apron in the kitchen and flipping a three-handled pan of eggs together in sync and saying, here come the eggs, like, you know, just everyone,
they
just
the
everything
Eggman.
They do, you know, are just doing everything. Yeah, exactly.
They're Eggman.
They love their
Eggman.
Eggs.
Eggman. So we start off with To All the Girls, which is a weird little interlude where he's just dropping little nod to all the women around the world.
I mean, that's a smooth track to pull. Okay, so that's the other thing to notice about Dust Brothers. So one of the cool things they talked about is that Dust Brothers already had about half the tracks that they laid down for this before the Beastie Boys arrived on scene. They're like, oh, we were thinking about this kind of like club music, like different ways to construct very different kind of music. And they're like, no, throw that in there. And it's like, that's part of why it's so sort of overpowering, because it's like, they are pretty busy backtracks for a rap song. And the beasties themselves are very busy bees on top of that. And you're just like, you need to calm down.
Have a margarita.
So to start off with that very smooth, I can't remember offhand where it's sampled from, but it's like a jazz album. Mm-hmm. It's a super, super smooth intro. Like it's awesome. It sets a mood, right?
It does. And then we go into Shake Your Rump. Shake your rumpa. For a while there, I thought he was saying shake you, like Europa.
Shake.
And I was like,
oh no, is this some more Kraftwerk crap again? I don't know what the hell is this about.
We are the robots. Never again.
No, I love Shake Your Rump. I think it's fun. It might be my highlight track. Other than that, it's up there for me. Let's keep going.
It's good. Got that fat synth business happening after the verses, which I really dug a lot. Sampled the woo-ha got you all in check. Somehow when I heard that, I was like, oh, this is where it came from. I was like, no.
Right.
That was also a sample from Sugar Hill Gang. Yep. Lisa, get your shit together.
But that's the fun part. That's the fun part about this album. And it's about kind of sensitizing to the game of hip hop. Yeah. Right. Where it's like, oh, this is basically like oral tradition kind of stuff. But it's like sample right. check to sample check to sample check.
Yes, and it just goes on. I was like, where does it end? Sugar Hill Gang sample something from like the 1920s? Right. Please, where does it end? I want to know.
It doesn't. That's the fun part.
Yeah. So there's Shake Your Rump, a real fun one. And then, oh my gosh, the real earworm? Earworm?
Is yeah, that earworm.
Earworm for the week for me is Johnny Rael.
Yeah. Weird, like, just the way it's sort of like, it woozes off the beat like a guy staggering in the street.
That's a very good observation. It does. Yeah.
And it sticks in your head that same way.
Johnny Rael. Yeah. Johnny Rael. Oh, it's a song about a man who was homeless in New York City at the time. In the song, they said he lived on stoop. I don't think that was correct, but they just gave him the name Johnny Rael and just documented a bit of his life in the song, which is super interesting, but all the nonsense he gets into in terms of drinking and panhandling and shit. But Johnny Rael is probably the catchiest song to me.
Interesting.
Do I like it that much?
Right.
No,
but it's
yeah. Yeah. And then we move on to Eggman.
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 I'm the trash man. The song was apparently born from the band's love for literally throwing eggs at people.
It was the 80s, man.
Which is on brand.
Right.
For their punky
trickster goofster guys.
The Jackass crew before Jackass was a thing. It's just a ridiculous song. And the way that they just say Eggman over and over and over again at the end with that ominous music.
They threw
music?
Eggs at you. Is this the sonic version of getting egged?
No, but I felt inspired to begin egging people because I was like, I don't think in 2021 you can just egg people without, especially in Texas, without risking being shot.
Did I tell you about Eggy Leggy?
Excuse me.
So a friend on the internet told when he was in school, when they were in middle school, they would play Eggy Leggy, where you put a raw egg in your pocket and the other guy's eggs in their pocket, and they knew, but you try to like cloak it out and just like try and go on to your normal routine throughout the day, but you had to defend your egg and you're trying to get the other guy's egg. So if you caught him unawares, you'd smash it in his pocket and he'd just have an egg drizzling down the side of his leg. You'd have Eggy Leggy. I feel like the Beastie Boys would definitely probably still be playing Eggy Leggy if they knew about it.
We should just text them. We have the number. 1-800-BEASTIE.
1-800-Eggman.
Beastie Besties. Eggman is great. Eggman might be my favorite because of the fact that it's just nonsensical. So much of it is. High Plains Drifters, track 5. This is the track with the weird like woman moaning in the background, which always caught me off guard every time I listened to it.
Especially because it is sort of a name check to, I mean, they love name checking pop culture stuff. And,
right.
And,
that's
and
what this was. Ton of references.
This is the Family Guy of the album in terms of just straight refs. up and down. But mm-hmm. yes, there's a, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, I was like, okay. I am trying to sit with my children
yeah.
and listen to, a, well, gosh, what's the age? 32-year-old album right
I'm
now?
I'm listening to the Beastie Boys. I ain't doing math.
Someone has to. High Plains Drifter, I do not like this track. Mm. Two thumbs down.
Well, it's like actually putting on the titular High Plains Drifter, which is a Western. I imagine the same. You make the same face.
Absolutely.
Putting on. You're like,
100%. No. Nope. No.
None of this.
The Sounds of Science. So it sounds like it samples one of those like cans that you flip and it makes like the sound.
Yeah.
I was like, if that's the sample, I would really love to know, but I don't think it is.
Well, with their very nasal delivery, they're certainly having fun, but it's like the sound, like you gotta nail that sound.
Yeah. And that to me was just like, this is the point of listening to the album that I was like, I'm not going to make it. But then they finally chill out because like it's super annoying up until I think verse two.
Uh-huh.
It finally stops annoying the right. piss out of me at that mm-hmm. point. And then the beat picks up and then, yeah. Also, when was the last time you heard a song drop a ref for Ponce de Leon?
Exactly. I mean, exactly. They would do anything. The funny one I saw a comparison to someone compared High Plains Drifter to a white nerdy version of Gimme the Loot in terms of
yes
so I like that comparison.
Mm-hmm. 100%. After Sounds of Science, which really tested me, we get 3 minute Rule. Dig the beat on that one.
Mm.
I do dig the beat on that one quite a bit. Also, they were... Oh, that's right. This is the track. It became apparent that they were really trying hard to make the word rope happen. And it's like, it's not going to happen, guys.
It's not going to happen.
Stop it. Like, what was the line? I'm so rope. I'm so rope? Stop it. 89, we had lots of sayings. They were so cool. They were so radical. Cowabunga. Yeah. You don't have to bring rope into this.
Nah,
I'm so rope.
We might have to make that happen.
Dope a rope. Soap on a rope. I'm yeah. so rope. Stop it.
Stop it.
Mike, go get some pizza. This was also recorded over a live ping pong game, which I read because they had a table in the studio. And so
really
they were
funny.
Trying to keep it in beat. And they're like, you can hear kind of get out of there. And but this what that just goes to show me is that like they just were having a blast
yeah.
on this album. And it is 100% apparent. 100%.
Yeah. There's a lot. There's the energy is still very high. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Have they ever made a sad song?
Sort of. You think back to
Intergalactic. That was yeah. a deeply sad song. No, it wasn't.
No, but the ending tracks to Hello Nasty get a little on the sadder side.
I'll have to go back and revisit yeah. that. Hello Nasty is quite good.
Hello Nasty is very good. Very, very good.
Also, one of the best album titles.
Yes.
Hello Nasty. What is that born from? We'll look at that.
The lyrics is you'll be like, hello, Nasty, where you been? It's time to get the grimy beats out the dungeon. It's a reference to like crate digging, like getting samples out of old crazy songs. So the record's so dusty and old, you're like, hello, Nasty.
As you say, as one totally says.
Yes, two records.
Naturally, two records.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Amazing. Thank you. Hey, ladies.
Get funky.
Yeah, some super funky samples in this one. I don't have much on Hey Ladies.
It's fun. I think this was the lead-off single. Didn't do so hot, but with a B-side to Shake Your Rump. It feels of the era. What I like is that when we're back to 89 and it's still not full on like I'm rapping and I'm here to say like you don't have that flow at least.
Right.
So
But Beastie Boys has, to me, has always walked that line. Even though they were
sure.
beyond that just a bit, they, yeah.
But you're starting in 86. There's going to be some element of it that is going to be hard to, just like, you know, guys that are famous for 10, 15 years. Like, it would be weird if Kanye just started in with the full, like, mumblecore flow that has, like, no apparent rhyming and a little singing and, you know, a lot of the stuff because the style wheelhouse of rap has just blown wide open
mm-hmm.
over the past couple of years.
I really love rap.
It's amazing
really
form.
Love
it's,
rap.
It's I'd say the preeminent form of our day.
Mm-hmm.
a preeminent sort of cultural music form, and it's interwoven to the other forms, and it's sort of freely adaptable in many ways. Mm-hmm. How could you not like rap?
I don't know.
Well, I could have some ideas, but
I did try listening to, well, as far as I can get into it, the before I just stopped, the If You Could Read This It's Too Late by Drake, which I've never listened to.
Oh, and cool.
I was like, that's pretty good. Pretty good. I don't recognize any of the tracks.
This fellow?
Is he Drake? Is he Canadian? He is. Back to the album, Five-Piece Chicken Dinner. All right, what the hell is this? Because why not, in the middle of an album, have like a banjo blowout?
Oh, that's, but again, it's the prankishness. So it's really funny. It's really fun.
It's completely outrageous.
It's outrageous, but also like they gut it with such gusto. Because it's not like... I think it would be more annoying if it were more just like, because there's not the ironic detachment of being like, oh, listen to this banjo, it fucking sucks, right? They're going like, you know, they're just going for it. It's so funny.
You wrecked our cats.
Yeah, he did not like that.
Both of them did not like that. There are two cats on the bed beside me. Heyo, that's how cool I am. Looking down the barrel of a gun. This to me is the nastiest sounding track.
Love
on the whole
it.
Album.
I don't know.
It's
good. I would say I wonder how they cooked up that beat, because it's it's got a lot
raunchy.
Of depth. It's raunchy. It's yeah.
And I heard that like grimy Mississippi Queen lick in there.
Uh huh.
I was like, ooh, because we haven't covered Mountain yet. But I'm looking. I think they're on the list.
Could be. I believe they are.
I believe they are too. I don't know how. I mean, I think they are. That album is worth definitely taking a look at. Car Thief.
Got to sell all your bona fides.
Mm-hmm. It's all about kicking ass.
I think
taking names.
Car Thief.
And filling cool brand cigarettes with cocaine. Did you read that?
No, I didn't. I didn't catch that. Although I think looking out of the barrel of a gun has the. It's either that or Car Thief. It is. There's the name check to a 20 gauge shotgun, which
I think it's Car Thief.
Okay, that's really funny, because gauge is based on how big the pellets are inside a shot shell. So the smaller they go, the higher the number.
Right.
So a 12 gauge is pretty serious. The 20 gauge is the baby version. So you're like, I pull out the smallest pistol.
Like, pew pew pew.
City Boys, it's okay.
Yeah, but honestly, I'm still stuck on that cocaine and the cool cigarette line, because that just made me think, like, it really made me think about, like, hey, that's one of the most buck wild things I've ever heard.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Also, this is late 80s in New York City, and that was a whole fucking thing.
Probably was a damn party. Yeah,
gosh, they had so much fun. I'm so jealous.
Yeah,
I want to.
Yeah.
Won't you please let me live in New York City?
In the 80s?
Now is fine, too.
No.
No,
right. Now is not fine, too.
What goes around comes around. What comes around, my dear. Track 12. This is a fun piece, and I love the line about Rapunzel, let down your hair so I can get into your underwear. I was like, yep, that's a good one.
Right.
What the fuck actually happens at the end of the song, though, with the, like, Pam, Alabama,
Who knows,
they went,
man?
I was listening to this. It didn't register with me the first few times. And then at the end, it was like, you guys went off the tracks on that one.
Yeah, they get a little goopy-loopy.
Goopy-loopy. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to add on what comes around?
I don't know.
These are not lyrically super deep tracks or anything. It's just fun. It's a study in samples.
Exactly. It's well, and again, the density. There are some tracks where they're basically like, they're not even singing around. It's like they're rapping simultaneously,
right?
And not just the same thing, they're rapping different things.
You're like, hey, shush. What I find interesting about this album is that as a whole, I loved it track by track. Like, I liked it all together. When I began sitting with a song track by track, I began to not like it.
I think that's why I was also interested for this album as an album, as a form for this show, because it's underappreciated in some respects. I think critically it's finally found its audience, but it's fascinating.
But once I spend a lot of time with it, I could sit back and be like, I know exactly why he picked this, and he's absolutely right. This is a great sample business, but we're not done yet. We still have Shadrach.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel, Book of Daniel. So they're comparing themselves to Old Testament figures, but also able to build off of a sample of, I think, Sly and the Family Stone, which is, for whatever reason, is referencing those three characters too. So just layered, not necessarily deep, but layered.
Did not expect a biblical-esque track on here.
Good Jewish boys. They're going to maybe, I mean...
Are they good Jewish boys?
Well, they're certainly Jewish boys.
This is true. There's certainly that. A billion pop culture references in that one, too. Too many to mention, truly. But then you get your little interlude for Ask for Janice. Mm-hmm. Little shout out to Paul's Boutique. And then you get B-Boy Booyah Bass.
Yeah, Booyah Bass.
What the hell does that mean?
It's a
French word, obviously.
Yeah. It's a soup or something? Is it a food? Big hearty dish of some kind.
Hidden in this 12-minute long ending is my favorite song. Oh. And mine is A Year and a Day.
Yes. Okay.
That's very good. That. When I was going through, I was like, no, this is a little different than everything else. Mm-hmm. And I really dug it. I also liked Dropping Names. Mm-hmm. It was a good piece. There are like, seven or eight tracks that belong to this?
Crazy. Yeah.
Most of them like a minute long.
Yeah.
I think I read that this section, this 12-minute long track, was like a lot of ideas they had that they were like, we could work more on this, or we could kind of just put them together into this little like...
Right, like a medley.
Like a medley. Who else did it that we cover? Was it the Beatles that had...
Yeah, you're thinking about the end medley of the Beatles, yeah.
Yeah.
Of Abbey Road. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hey, once the sketch of this idea is over, just go to the next one. It's fine.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a fully formed everything. But together, it came together to be a 12-minute long, really dynamic piece at the end.
Right.
Fully going from one end of the spectrum to the other of what they were doing on this album.
Yes. And to me, without getting into more of what they would chart for themselves in terms of... like their musicianship, because they would grow as musicians playing their music, but they would also grow in terms of being MCs in the kind of traditional classic, like sample based or record based hip hop stuff. This album and here, like, it charts, it sort of brackets. It's like, this is what you can expect, right? We're going to do a lot more of this moving forward. Like, again, to me, this is the inception of the modern Beastie Boys is in this. And I think that's reflected in when they did their best of. It was called The Sound of Science.
Mm. Interesting.
So I think for themselves, a lot of their ideas, a lot of their sense of themselves, I think, matured, or at least came more fully formed in this album. And it didn't matter if other people didn't get it. I think that they came forward from there much more assured, much more fully themselves.
Into it.
Yeah.
Do you have a takeaway?
Frantic.
Frantic? Mine was raucous. I think Frantic is better.
It's just so much. There's so much going on. It's fun to listen with the headphones because you just see how much layer. I mean, that's not easy. It's not easy to not... I mean, because even the production themselves... So if you're saying, well, who cares about the Dust Brothers, as mentioned when we talked about them before, you probably know Dust Brothers from their very first soundtrack outing, which was they were tapped by David Fincher to do the soundtrack for Fight Club. And the same kind of dizzying sample switching melting pot of sounds that they brought to Fight Club. That's one of the reasons I remember being very interested in Paul's Boutique, because it was like, oh, Dust Brothers. This, I don't know, I was in college, of course, a white guy in college when Fight Club had just come out a year or two later. I discovered it and I was really into that soundtrack, just because there was, Fight Club came out in 1999. There was no one ever really doing something then as of now with a soundtrack that was that dense. I honestly, it kind of makes me think of Euphoria as far as a more DJ sample heavy kind of approach to a soundtrack, to an OST for some show or a movie. Mm-hmm. It's just not a common thing. I just mean like, who are these guys? I remember, I actually did know because they also produced Bex Odelay.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So I was like, wait a minute, I remember the Dust Brothers. Bex Odelay, and then looking back, I was like, oh, Paul's Boutique, what's this about? And turns out the Dust Brothers have been on their shit for decades.
Turns like, out.
it's that part I don't feel like has aged. You know, it's like, it's so dense and like to actually time it out, especially without aid of a lot of digital equipment, right? This is sampling and getting the timing exactly right. To land one of those samples in time and splice that in and do that over and over and over.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's a 53-minute long album and it's chock full of it, and they did a great job. They really did. And again, like I said, from start to finish, I really did enjoy this album. I'm glad we covered it because I would not have ever touched it otherwise. Because it was the wrong time frame and the wrong band for me. But giving it a shot, I see, as a cohesive work, it actually is a very good album.
Yeah.
Very good. So.
And it means, you know, that because like the old saw about the old joke about Velvet Goldmine, right? Is that
who?
Velvet Goldmine, Lou Reed.
Okay.
The joke is that only 100 people ever bought their first album when it came out, but every one of those 100 people started a band.
Yeah.
So you can, I feel like you hear an album like this and you can think about some kid, especially some New York kid, who is like, this was an important text to them, right? A young LP probably was a big fan of this album and both repping New York and thinking about, you know, production and like what you can get away with, what you can do, right? What kind of sounds you can conjure. They throw in some banjo and start screaming over it. Just, why the fuck not?
Like, why not?
Don't be limited. And when you have those examples set for you, it's exactly like, I mean, I honestly hit a point where late in high school, someone was like, well, do you want to make computer games? And I was like, I never thought of me being the person to make video games.
Mm-hmm. No, like
someone has to. Yeah, it was a mistake. but that's how it is. When people get inspired, when kids get inspired, you gotta have examples for yourself.
Truth.
So there you go. So I will be opening a boutique. That's the example.
I can't wait to visit you in your new life in New York City.
My new menswear boutique.
You'll have a bodega cat too, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. That's the boutique. It's a bodega cat boutique where cats. Bodega cat are furnished for bodegas in New York City.
Yeah.
You got to step up your game. They're like, oh my gosh, look at the quality of bodega cat I could have.
This black and white one loves to sunbathe. This orange one loves to get on the Coke machine. And like, it's the best. Okay. I want to cover something fun next week, and I want to cover, I assume it's fun. We'll see what happens.
Beastie Boys were just a little too dour for you.
Yeah, I'm so depressed. I want to do Back in Black, AC/DC.
All right.
You into it?
Oh, yeah. No, that'll be fun.
Yeah. I need some rock. I was like, I don't think I'm ready. The Rolling Stones are on here. I've never really been a Rolling Stones fan. I'm more open to AC/DC. So let's soft pedal and do AC/DC, Back in Black. And that'll be what we cover next week. So
hell yeah.
So that was Beastie Boys, fun. Paul's Boutique, 1989. Get into it.
Take your rumba.
Bye.